Ladies and gentlemen, this is an episode of Mixed Mental Arts. As always, my colleague, Hunter Motz, the man with the biggest brain in the room, and he's got strong Dutch thighs. I wish he squatted weight because you'd be off the charts, my friend. But you're too smart for that. You would never squat. You might put too much damage on your lower back nerve roots. John Durant, one of my favorite people I never see, back in style with his left-wing shoes, but his right-wing ideology. He's got long hair and a beard, and he wrote that great book, Paleo Manifesto, a book I think about all the time. I swear to God, I actually think about it all the time because I think it had a lot to say, and I thought it had a very unique angle. Welcome to the Mother of All Podcasts, Mixed Mental Arts.
Mother of Dragons podcast.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Good to be back.
It's good to have you. He brought me a wine, 2015, everybody. Like I drink wine that's 2 years old. I'm sorry. Let me get catch my breath. Pauper. Now, I'm kidding.
You bring someone a gift, and this is what you
and
get.
This is what you get. I want to jump right into how you feel about the man you voted for.
Oh, God.
Because, and I'm sorry to blindside you, but he's so unbelievable to me in that, you know, I don't even mind that he said both sides are to blame. I actually don't even mind that. I don't think he was necessarily, I don't think he's smart enough to even think deeply enough to think about whether he's putting both sides on the same footing. But this is a guy who tweeted, study what General Pershing did, and basically they didn't have terrorism for the next 35 years. For anybody who doesn't know what he did, there's a myth, because it's been widely debunked by historians, that General Pershing, when there was a Muslim uprising in the South Philippines, in the southern Philippines, he took 50 rebels, shot 49 of them with bullets dipped in pig's blood, and let the 50th one go back to his group to tell them that, well, you know, this is what they did. And apparently that cured terrorism for the next 35 years. Mm-hmm. War crime. We have a president talking this way. So it's, you know, you wonder at times if he's just, his temperament doesn't allow him to think clearly.
I mean, I do think with some of the tweets, he's trying to refocus attention, you know, mm-hmm. rather than whatever the most recent crisis
yeah.
is.
Yeah.
So that's what I imagine he was doing with that tweet.
So yeah, I think you would allow that he's, at best, the best way to be charitable is he's very clumsy.
I mean, sometimes, like with his statement after Charlottesville, what I think he should have said, or what would have been more effective, would have been to condemn white supremacy, neo-Nazi shit, all that crap.
Yeah.
And if you're going to talk about both sides, I think it's appropriate to talk about it, but maybe you talk about it in terms of a cycle of violence. I mean, mm-hmm. we're what,
good
a month
point.
Away from a GOP member of Congress almost being assassinated, multiple people shot at the GOP, you know, baseball game by somebody who volunteered on the Bernie Sanders campaign.
Yeah.
To think that there isn't violence going in both directions is...
I agree.
Right.
I mean, I think from what I heard, the chancellor or whatever the word is of Berkeley has a safe room. They're not, the left wing is, the radical
right.
left wing is,
right.
is they think the same way in many ways, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they're not really interested in changing anything. They're interested in a fight and power, I would imagine.
Yeah, when it comes to disavowals or apologies, I think he is a type of person that feels like he's been put in a corner and
yeah.
forced to do something. He just senses the power dynamic of they're trying to force me to do something, so he resists it.
Yeah.
That's my charitable interpretation of it.
What do you think about taking down statues that have been there a long time, even if it's Robert E. Lee or Stonewall Jackson?
I mean, so here's the thing. So what I...
Because I don't have an answer, so I'm not here to...
Yeah.
I'm not here to try to catch you in anything, because I'd rather discuss it, because I haven't... I'm torn on the subject, and I'll tell you why when you tell me what you think.
Yeah, I mean, look, just because a statue exists does not mean it has to continue to exist for all time. And local communities can decide what is a symbol that they want to rally around or what is a symbol they don't want there anymore. I mean, look, when we conquered Nazi Germany, like,
yeah.
you know, all the symbols came down.
Which I think was a little excessive. I look, at the end of the day, it's what the meaning you attach to the symbol, everybody.
It was a Buddhist symbol.
I just believe in white pride. That's all I'm talking about. I don't know why I sound like I'm Woody Allen right now.
What concerns?
I would love to see Woody Allen come out and do that. I believe in white pride at the end of the day.
What concerns me is that the people who are in, you know, basically using an online mob to say, or a physical mob to bring down some of these statues, they're a lot of times the same people or the same side as people saying that there need to be trigger warnings on classical literature. It's like ultra safe space stuff.
Yeah.
If our college campuses were not as insane as they are right now, I would be much more open to a reasonable conversation about which monuments we wanted in the world and which ones we didn't. I mean, there just over the last week, there has been a monument of Abraham Lincoln that was set on fire.
God.
Abraham Lincoln.
God.
There's some monuments, I believe in Wisconsin or Minnesota or something like that, that were to Confederate soldiers who had been prisoners of war, and due to neglect, most of them died, in a prison camp. And so, like, they were buried there, and they got a monument. Like, I don't think, but that monument got taken down. It's like when we act as mobs, we're really dumb.
I agree.
Humans are dumb in mobs.
Because there's an interesting argument to say that it's all part of history. And even if some of that history is controversial, I mean, because if you take Robert E. Lee, for example, if some of the letters that he wrote to his wife are interesting, because he said, I believe slavery to be a moral and social or political evil. However, it's more detrimental to the white man. And in fact, I believe that this is good, rigorous discipline for the black man. And the only way he'll ultimately be set free is through this rigorous discipline. Oh, and by the way, they're doing way better than they ever have done in Africa. And he had his own sort of twisted morality around it, because it was up to Providence to free the slaves. And you have to take these things into context. And I don't think we're taking these things into historical context. I think you have to be a historical relativist in some ways to at least, he was an American figure. And he is a fact of American life. And if I was black, I'm sure I would find that statue way more offensive than I do. It's not a trigger for me. What I've read about Robert E. Lee in my limited reading of Civil War was, I always thought of him as he's painted as a brilliant tactician, a sober, well-dressed, regal man of great pride, a military man.
West Point, top of his class.
Yeah, yeah. So you get this idea, and again, as you know, there are people who are complicated. And back then, everybody owned slaves.
Right.
And back then, being white was de facto to be a white supremacist. You were, not everybody, but you were educated in that regard. So it was very hard to sort of separate, well, your culture from your belief system, right?
And, I mean, it's very easy for this to sound like it is a rationalization or a justification for slavery, which is obviously abhorrent. Slavery existed all over the world.
Yeah.
It was
an order,
I believe,
of the day.
You know, the English that led the way with with ending it.
They were
William Wilberforce.
That was Hunter Motz, everybody.
Take a bow.
You got two words, dude. He remembers names like I've never seen in my life.
Only with alliteration.
I have the worst memory. I chop it all up, and he's like, nah, nah, nah. I'm like, Jesus, he's incredible.
So, so the Native Americans had slaves, pre-Columbian contact. So slavery was a worldwide evil.
Mm-hmm.
It saw some of its greatest horrors in the American South. Like the U.S. also.
Maybe, or maybe not.
I don't know
when the Turks captured Constantinople and took 150,000 people. I don't know how fun that march back to Istanbul.
Yeah, you're right.
That's where Istanbul is, but I don't know how fun that was to be captured by.
Or the Mongols.
Or the Mongols were a sweetheart of a group. I mean, yeah, your daughters, even if they were 12, were sold off to, you know.
And sometimes people will say, like, Southern or Civil War apologists will say, "Oh, this is about heritage, not just the war." I mean, the Civil War was definitely from the South's perspective was about slavery. I'm not actually sure slavery was the main motivation on the North. I think on the North it more was about union and control, not slavery. And slavery became a tactic later on. I mean, the Emancipation Proclamation didn't happen until years into the war. So it definitely was the primary issue on the South. You can say states' rights, but like that was the main.
I don't even know that it was the primary issue on the South. I mean, you know, there was a tiny group of people who owned slaves. The vast majority did not. And especially in terms of what we talked about with culture, like that's an honor culture. That's what Southern culture is. And a lot of it is, you know, if you read Shelby Foote, a lot of it was just about loyalty. Right, loyalty. Robert E. Lee fought for Virginia because he was loyal to Virginia, and then within the course of the war starts to realize what he signed himself up for. But the problem is that history is written by the victors, and so obviously the North has then told the story in a way that has made it into a moral cause, where now it was about slavery, and now they were the bad guy, and anybody who questions this is now suddenly in the position of having to defend slavery.
Yeah, and I don't think, I think it'd be naive to think that the Northern Alliance was they were not white supremacists, and in fact they were fighting for this great evil. I think you're right. I think it was economic too for a lot of the South, right? There was this idea that we have this white gold and all this free labor and can't afford to do this right now. But it weighed on everyone's conscience. There's no question that everybody knew. They knew that it was bad.
I don't know about that either.
Really? I feel like that was part of. And I still think that's part of the fabric. I think it's actually impossible to justify. You know, let me give you an example. There's a historian, I can't remember her name, who was talking about how Robert E. Lee was one of the guys who would break up black families. And that was kind of in many places considered, from what I've read, that was not always the case. That was actually thought of as a pretty harsh measure because a lot of these families on black plantations would go back generations. And to break the family up was really considered to be, you know, you can imagine the kind of heartache and the hysteria it caused and, you know, all that. And so, I don't know, you know.
Well, there is that basic human decency of seeing the other person's face. But the whole point of racism is to dehumanize African Americans so that you can do those things to them. And there are degrees to which people bought into that ideology that they were subhuman. But I think some people really, really bought in. I mean, if you look at, like, I think the other thing too, Brian, is that part of, I think, what you're hinting at is our own parents, right? Like, if you're expecting your mom or your dad to be either a god or a devil, you're going to be disappointed. They're a human being, they're messy, they're conflicted, they have good points and they have bad points. Same thing is true for our founding fathers. Like, you know, they are not perfect, but they're not all inveterate racist assholes, right? And in fact, they can be both inveterate racist assholes and still be great political visionaries. And I mean, for me, the Civil War, I mean, the real conflict of the Civil War always comes down to Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was simultaneously the greatest cavalry general of the Civil War and also the founder of the KKK. Wow. And you have to deal with the fact that he can be a brilliant military strategist and have founded one of the worst organizations ever in the United States history.
And yeah, to complicate things even further, you know, we project our current alliances back on the past. and
that's a really good point.
We view the South as intolerant Republican assholes, racist assholes.
Yeah.
And the North as tolerant Harvard, you know, liberal Massachusetts, whatever. I mean, if you took another group, if you took Jewish folks, I mean, the first Jewish senator was Judah P. Benjamin from Alabama. I forget if it was Alabama or maybe Georgia. Maybe we can look that up. But he was Secretary of War in the Confederacy.
Wow.
And to your point about it being economic, the Southern economy was more agrarian, and
which requires a lot of labor.
Right. The highest status thing in the South that you could be would be like a plantation owner. Mm-hmm. And those people didn't want, like, they weren't in the merchant class. They would stay on their plantations. Mm-hmm. And so you did have a little bit of a Jewish merchant class that was complementary to the landed aristocracy
down there.
Whereas in the North, there's a bunch of writing showing that anti-Semitism was stronger in the North than it was in the South.
Wow.
So we project our current alliances on the past, and the past is messy and more complicated than we think it is.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I think the problem today is that we are breaking up into strong teams. Maybe we always have, but it's almost like the sport of the day is to bash the other team and not deal with the problem in the middle. That's what I'm noticing.
So, and I think people, a lot of people disagree with me on this. I think on Charlottesville, the media and Antifa or non-Antifa, just counter-protesters, may have taken the wrong approach.
Well, I stole your idea because I saw your tweet.
Yeah.
And I didn't give you credit. But on Fighter and the Kid, I said, what we should have done, and it makes total sense, is whenever there's a march, a white supremacy march, all you do is just don't show up. Nobody should show up. Empty the streets and let them shout in the air.
To nobody.
Yeah, or to nobody. Or just continue eating your lunch and don't even look up. And let them do their thing, like the way you do to traffic when people bleep their horns. But when you have all these cameras on them and stuff like that, gee whiz, it's like you're gonna give them a lot of significance.
This elevates their importance. It makes them and other people believe that they are persecuted and fighting for.
Makes them heard.
Yeah. And there have been a lot of not going to go into names and stuff like that, but there have been a lot of profiles of various people in that small movement. Mm-hmm. The amount of media that group has gotten is just way out of proportion compared to the number of people. Like, David Duke has never been, nobody gives a shit about David Duke. Like,
I know.
Like, he doesn't have a following.
No.
Like, he's not a national leader.
Yeah. I don't worry.
Like, white supremacists are infiltrated by the FBI to a serious degree.
Yeah. Like, and by the way, when I think of these white supremacists, they're such a small minority. I actually don't think about that. What I worry about and what I think about is that when you do have a large group of people who are fair-minded, I don't think they're racist. I was just down in Florida on the border of Alabama performing for a bunch of guys in the Panhandle. And they were all vendors. And they all talked like this. And they were all, white, good old boys. And I had some deep talks with some of those guys about this situation. And I swear to God, to a man, they were like, I'm not prejudiced. I'm not a racist. I don't like, they just don't trust or like how the large debate, first of all, how they're portrayed.
Right.
Which is with a total lack of respect and dignity.
Total contempt.
Total contempt and condescension.
Yeah.
And also the fact that they're very much stereotyped and categorized. And then on top of the fact that they don't feel like they necessarily have a voice or even a future with the way things are moving. They have a culture. And there are maybe backward things about that culture as there are about lots of culture, including Latino, Black, and even white culture. I mean, whatever.
Yeah.
There are certain things in a culture that don't fit into the 21st century economy. But there's also value in their culture.
Right.
There's also things in their culture that, a lot of those guys who listen to sports radio, like Camille Paglia says, those are the guys that go off and fight your fucking wars for you. And you have to respect that. Because when the shit hits the fan, those are the patriots that suit up,
Yep.
And when the shit hits the fan, we all go like this. Somebody's taking care of that, right? Somebody's taking care of the guys who run vans in the entire, or who are looking for a dirty bomb. We're on that. We better be. Well, a lot of those guys are patriots, and a lot of those guys come from a tradition that believes in certain things that may not be very politically correct. The point I'm making is that what I think is that there is a large group of people that are essentially feeling as though they are under siege. And I don't think they're racist, but I do think they're afraid. I do think they're angry, and I do think they're feeling betrayed. And if we don't listen to them, and if we don't give them, and we were going back to this before we started recording, it's very easy to lack compassion for something you don't understand. But if you understand it, if you understand what's going on, if you understand where this person is coming from, or understand how that artist did that one thing. I was using the example of a one brushstroke painting. When you watch, when I see a one, I would see this brushstroke and I'd be like, whatever. And then somebody told me, well, that's a Japanese technique where you can't take your brush off the page. And you've got to do that. And then you see what these people are able to do with just one brushstroke. Holy fuck. Like, I can't stop looking at it. It gives you, you're awed and floored by this art form because of its restriction. The same thing goes for human beings. If you really understand where they're coming from, you will have compassion and understanding. And I think that's what we're lacking on both sides.
The we've ended up in a place where elites on both the right and the left share a lot more in common culturally than they often do with working class on either side. And when we're having these debates over monuments and stuff like that, we're debating symbols and what's the right word choice and all this other stuff. In many ways, these are elite games to see who can play the game most effectively, memorize what pronouns you're supposed to use and not to use, and which symbols are good and which symbols are bad, and is Alexander Hamilton a good founding father or a bad founding father? Is that Andrew Jackson? And who are we going to take off the... Like, we're fighting these very abstract symbolic battles where, you know, that emphasize identity politics. And if we're going to start... Like, the more we emphasize identity politics, the more there's going to be white identity in response to it.
It's the little enders and the big enders. So in Gulliver's Travels, right, Gulliver goes to visit the Lilliputians and the Blefuscans, and they have the same holy book, Al-Quran, and the same prophet. But there's this one line in the book that says that all true believers must eat their hard-boiled eggs from the convenient end. So half of the people decide that it's the big end is the convenient end, and the other half decide that the little end of the egg is the convenient end, and then this becomes this symbolic, ideological war over how we should eat our hard-boiled eggs, which, of course, has nothing to do with the substance of the text, what it's supposed to be about and all that. And absolutely, like, it's all symbolic battling and tribalism, and we're wasting all of our attention and time on these extremists, these fundamentalists, rather than the common group of people in the middle, the reasonables, actually ganging up on the real problems, which require sustained attention, require thought, require reflection.
And
awesome. I'm gonna steal that. Keep
both. Neither.
Did I say that out loud? Did I say that out loud? It's good to have really smart friends, because then you sound awesome when you're talking to regular folk. Because I'm a regular folk.
Steals all of our ideas, and I get $1
out of
it.
Dude,
I'm a cup of coffee.
I'm literally a parrot. I'm just a parrot, but keep going. You guys do the thinking, and I'll take the credit when I parrot your stuff.
I can't remember this person's name.
Exactly.
Hunter?
I hope I'm not talking to anybody who listens to the podcast, but they never do.
But to one of your original points about how things are getting so polarized and so heightened, it's a dynamic that is, it's sort of like an earthquake almost, right? Where an earthquake happens and like it just seeks out weaknesses and those things shatter.
Yeah.
That's basically what's going on right now. And the media plays into it. Mm-hmm. Trump plays into it for sure, no question. And then the media plays into it. I mean, we have gone from, like, the media has been throwing the word Nazi around for the last year and a half.
Yeah.
And then somebody showed up with a Nazi flag, and how do you turn up the volume any more than...
Well, this is what I was... I did a joke the other day about when Google, when this guy was fired, I read that memo.
Yeah.
And I don't remember his name, but this... James Damore. You're amazing. Hunter knows all the names. James Damore writes this 10-page memo. And... he was fired, and one of the reasons given was that he made the workspace unsafe for women. And you know, when you start using words like an unsafe workspace, it's Google, motherfuckers.
Yeah.
It's Google with a bunch of like programmers who are usually
dorky, shy programmers.
Yeah. Navy SEALs have a dangerous workplace.
Right.
When you got to look at your canary, you know. And every time you're digging into the side of a, you know, rock because you're a mile underground, and if that thing falls and you got to grab your gas mask, it's what I call an unsafe work environment. And I, to your point, I think we are really abusing this language. I don't take you seriously. It's like boy cried wolf stuff.
I want
to hear what Rachel has to say. I want to hear a female's point of view. Good. God, that's so hot. She's like, I'm going to agree with everything John says.
Pretty great.
And what man doesn't love when a woman says that? I married my wife because when we were dating, she goes, wherever he goes, I'm going. I was like, huh? Yeah! Anyway, I was like, I'm 6'4". Anyway, sorry.
I mean, Google is one of the best employers to work for, not just in the country, but in the world. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think people are fighting over it. It's an incredibly wealthy, basically a monopoly. Mm-hmm. They have more or less a monopoly on search. Nobody is like a real big competitor. Incredibly lucrative. That attracts a lot of people who want to be a part of that. It's high status. It's cool. This guy, James Damore, he was originally going to get a PhD in biology. He ended up, I think, getting a master's and then jumping off to go work for Google. If he had gone into biology, a PhD in biology, he would have been in a field that is heavily female. And he would have fit right in. You know, you've seen this guy talk. He's, you know, unassuming.
He's not a bro. It's not like he's
bro grammar term is total bullshit. There are fratty alpha jock dudes in Silicon Valley, no question. Sure. Particularly sales guys and some CEOs and things like that. Like, for most software engineers, they were the nerds in high school. They were the nerds in middle school. They've been picked on and bullied probably for their entire lives. And then for them to suddenly read in the newspaper that they're the jocks and to be slandered because they're the jocks, it's totally, totally ludicrous. It is a slur against nerds, mostly, by feminists, by like ultra feminists who want to attack them and say that they're, you know, evil and misogynistic.
How are they controlling the narrative? This is what drives me crazy. How are they? Why are we so afraid of them? Why are corporations so afraid of this fringe group? Why are they so afraid of the fact, you know,
well,
Chris
Sacca?
Chris Sacca, I think the venture capitalist, he touched a woman's face, had to resign. This is outrageous. I mean, this is getting to a point where we're losing our, that they're not reasonable people. And there are ideologues. And if you listen to Jordan Peterson, he's very articulate in how this is cultural Marxism. They break the world up into power. It's all power structure. It's all power relationships. There's the oppressed and the oppressor.
Right.
That's the narrative on the left, and the right has its own narrative. But, you know, they seem to be controlling and getting to reasonable people and ruining careers and ruining, there are different ways to deal with this, you know. And I don't know why they have so much power and why we're so afraid of it.
In Silicon Valley, I think part of like the deep underlying issue is that a lot of the guys there are kind of dorky and nerdy
and afraid.
Mm-hmm. And they are nice. Like
they are nice.
These
people.
Software engineers are some of the most like supportive of feminism.
Yeah, they're
and,
good
like,
guys.
Nice
yes,
guys
I have nothing in common with them. Yeah, but I admire them and do respect them.
They're not like lax bros or something like that.
No,
know? No. And a lot of them with Gamergate, they wanted to play video games, just whatever games they wanted to play. A lot of them just sort of want to be left alone,
mm-hmm.
And not have to deal with, you know, with culture war, or symbolic wars.
Yeah, I think firstly, why are they so powerful? Well, you know, where does all that crowd come from? They come from the universities. And so there's a massive cultural bias in the universities that John Haidt talks about. I think the separate thing, though, is that there are huge cultural biases within different fields, right? So the cultural bias in biology may be towards women, right? But the cultural bias within, say, software programming or math is towards men. And the part of that is just cultural, right? We had Stephen Strogatz on, who is a professor of math at Cornell University, and he said, you go to a math department like Cornell, it's a giant sausage fest. He didn't use the word sausage fest. I'm taking liberties there. But he says, you go to a math department in Hungary, it's 50-50. Male to female. So I'm not, what I'm saying is that, listen, James Damore is, I think the other thing too is, you know, he put out his 10-page document, and it's a really, really good example of he used some science But when you use some science, you can create a misleading picture. I don't think he did it intentionally. I don't think it was, deliberate.
What do you think was misleading?
I think what was misleading is how human intelligence works. Human intelligence is social intelligence, and, you have to look at, is the community inviting or is the community not inviting? I mean, John Haidt did a really good summary of the James Damore thing, and he said, the guy's right. Right, the guy is right in the sense that there is a bias, there is a difference, right, in women pursuing these things. It's not a difference of talent or potential. But
how do you know?
Well, this was John Haidt's analysis of the science, right?
Charles Darwin,
yeah,
had a view that on the sexes and achievement level in the sexes that was closer to Damore than it was to his critics. It's not to say Darwin is right. It was what he was known for. It was within his area of expertise. And his basic view was that if you look, forget humans, if you look at all these other species, there are different behavioral psychological tendencies among the sexes and other species. And so he thought, he considered back in the 1840s or the 1850s,
right,
whenever he was considering this stuff, and I think it was published in 1861 or something. I think it was the Civil War date. He considered the idea that males and females were psychologically essentially identical, and it was all cultural, because critics aired that, and he said, "Yeah, you just look at other species, and there's so many like obvious differences, and they don't have culture the way that they do. That there must be some genetic predisposition."
I think there's no doubt that men's and women's brains are different, right? Women have a thicker corpus callosum, and
we like that,
yeah, because it means that there is more bihemisphere thinking, right? But at the same time, and there's no doubt that testosterone affects a man's brain. We've all felt that, right?
Have you ever read the reports of various trans folks who are start to take testosterone and how it alters their thinking?
Mm-mm.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. There was one on NPR in the early 2000s. There's one in a book called Heroes, Rogues, and Lovers on testosterone. The NPR one, which is online, people can go look at it. It was I believe a self-described butch lesbian who started taking testosterone. And she described how, visually, she became more turned on, sexually turned on just by, looking at things. Mm-hmm. And then this is on NPR. This is not me.
Yeah.
On NPR, she says, and science started to make sense to me.
Science,
and everyone
yeah.
on NPR gasps. It's like,
well, because what Hunter was saying this, the left ignores the science when it comes to the gender debate.
Right.
And the right ignores the science when it comes to the climate change debate. It's amazing how confirmation bias is alive and well and so strong in all of us. But that's a classic example. If you're telling me, I have 25 minutes in my new stand-up on the difference between boys and girls, the hardwired difference. And I have a son and a daughter, so I see it every single day. I don't mean to be, that's a myopic, anecdotal example. And of course, there are expressions in the middle of that. And of course, there's overlap. But you have to take into account that the majority of evolutionary biologists and psychologists agree that biology plays a fucking role. A woman can have, children. She makes food with her breasts, to quote Joe Rogan. There are very big differences, And to suggest that their brains aren't different when a 48-hour-old infant who's a female looks at a male is more likely to look at a human face than is a boy who's more likely to look at a moving object. We have measurable empirical evidence,
right,
and it's overwhelming. So it's amazing to me how these people I have another theory on the radical left, and for that matter, the radical right, because they're the same people. I don't think they're very smart. I don't think they're very smart. And I think that they're damaged. I think they're emotionally damaged typically. And they're probably, they sound like real narcissists in many ways, but they're not, they're just not responsive to evidence.
Yeah.
They're fighting about something else. That whether it's a creepy uncle or a father that didn't pay any attention to him, whatever it might be.
And you can hear it in debates. And I've been in debates where I've done this, where, yes, you're debating whatever issue you're talking about, but really what you feel is the power dynamic in the room and in the conversation, and you just want to make sure you win, whether or not you're, like, right or not.
It's
and if you're going to respond to the evidence, if you're going to be somebody who's going to actually try and practice science, you're going to be wrong a lot because there are 60 million scientific papers. It is so far beyond the capacity of an individual human brain at this point that you're going to be constantly confronted with things that you don't know. And so you can't have your ego involved in the equation. And the problem with extremists is that they are real precious about their ideas. Their whole identity is wrapped up in it. And one of the best things I've ever heard is there's a guy, Dave Colon, I know at Second City, and he said, the thing about racists is that they're people who really love their dads because they just couldn't admit that their dads were wrong about literally anything.
It's fantastic. It's fantastic. I just look at those guys as not that smart, and they latch onto an ideology. They want to be part of a team. And when you do that, when you latch onto an ideology or a team, young people do this. When you're a teenager, you do this a lot of times. These bullet points seem to make sense to you viscerally for whatever reason, and then you just assume they've done all the thinking for you. Some sharp profile at the top has done all the bulk of the thinking for you, and you just repeat. I do this at 50. I do this. I know. At 50, Rachel was like, "What? Oh my God!" Her eyes said that in a glance. But at 50, I will find myself lecturing people on insulin. I don't really know how insulin works in the body, but I read Gary Taub's book, and so I've read your book, but I'll tend to kind of talk about slow carbs, and then I'll cure people's psoriasis with a lectin-free diet because I read one book and it worked for me, and so we all do this. I don't know all the details, but boy, did it make sense. The first couple chapters made a lot of sense, and I was like, don't have time to read the whole book.
But now I have strong opinions and can lecture people.
Of course I have strong opinions, yeah.
So I'd be interested to know, in terms of people being attracted to ideologies, I'd be interested to know both among the Charlottesville white supremacist, white nationalist protesters, or among, say, Antifa, wherever they've protested, how many of them have kids? Like,
it's funny you say that because I'm listening to this course on Nietzsche. And Nietzsche, and thank you.
Nietzsche.
And I've done my due diligence. I've really tried to really read my, my Hegel and my Kant and my Schopenhauer and my, I listen to 60 lectures twice on the great ideas of philosophy. And I just am fascinated with it. But one of the things I noticed that I find fascinating is that most of these guys never got laid. Yeah. They never got laid. And by the way, they lived with their mom. I mean, I'm serious. I mean, they lived alone. They were terribly isolated. And so their outlook on life is just, God damn. I mean, Socrates, Nietzsche said about Socrates, well, we should start with the fact that he was ugly. Meaning he never got fucking laid. So you got to take everything he says with a... Of course he wanted to treat his body with a quiet contempt. Of course the greatest love isn't carnal love. That's very base.
Yeah.
It's to contemplate all the time. Bro, you never had a threesome. Come walk in my shoes when I was younger, everybody. But you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of... A woman, a beautiful woman, if you're lucky enough to have that experience, is overwhelming, And it can change your whole life, but there's nothing like great wine, great friends, great food, and a beautiful woman. For me, you know what I mean?
Right.
That can change your whole value system. Yeah. Men fight fucking bulls because a woman is in the stands.
Right.
I mean, and unfortunately, the people that you read who are deep thinkers sometimes never had that experience.
And as a society, we have more and more males in particular who don't have kids or getting older and aren't married. And in any society, the more like single young males you have, the more volatile it's going to be. And the more they're going to look for groups to identify with and to go like basically conquer something.
Or, and you're right, you're 100% right. And the other thing, that Camille Paglia was talking about the fact that a lot of people on the left in power, if you look at Obama's cabinet and places like that, smart people, and I've met some of them, good people, and I don't think they're, but most of them have never served in the military, probably haven't done a contact sport, and certainly have never worked with their hands, and moreover, if you listen to what she says, whether she's right or not, but I can believe it, haven't really even met or certainly aren't friends with anybody who is a blue-collar person. And Sam Harris, by his own admission, I listen to his podcast, and I like it a lot, but he said, I looked in my Rolodex out of the 1,100 people in my phone, the only person that ever smoked was Christopher Hitchens. And that was his own self-indictment and the fact that he's not, because Charles Murray in his podcast said that Trump is being used as the sort of white working class's murder weapon.
Right.
And it was a really kind of a shocking metaphor, but it makes a lot of sense. But that's significant. That's significant. I travel this country. I'm around, my fan base is guys who work with their hands, who are, you know, who punch you in the face, you know? I mean, I'm, and I have a great deal of respect for those guys because I know them on an intimate basis. I know how fair-minded most of them are.
Right.
I know, you know, it's a huge misconception to think that they're not interested intellectually, too, to Hunter's point, which he always says. It's a huge misconception to think that they're actually not interested. They just have to be, they have to show, when they're shown that this can be used as ammunition, that this is relevant, these are the things that they tend to, you know, cling to.
Yeah, and I mean, in terms of Trump is their murder weapon. I mean, it's a group of people. In many ways, labor unions felt sold out by the Obama administration with Obamacare getting the Cadillac plan sort of taxed and sort of cut out of that, and more, you know, big trade deals which they weren't in favor of. So they're kind of like both parties. Neither party is standing up for my interests. It's not that Trump is just a murder weapon towards the left. He's a murder weapon towards the right, too. He destroyed the Republican Party when he won the nomination. And then a lot of people said, well, now he just has to destroy one more party.
But see, to your point, Durant, young men who are angry and lost go looking for an ideology that offers them the promise to remake the world. And my feeling is that, you know, it's the same thing in the Middle East, right? That's what ISIS is about, right? It's young guys who don't have a path to dignity, right? They want to get a job, they want to get a house, they want to get married, they want to have a good life. And I think the point is that we need to channel that energy. That energy is going to go, and it's either going to go to the left or the right or ISIS or whatever it is. But I think that rather than sort of denying those male impulses, we should say, you want to remake the world? Here's what it's going to take. Right, it's going to take basically taking back the internet and sparking a remaking and a reinventing of the world, drawing on the best of everything that we have ever known. And it's, you know, but I think that energy needs to be channeled, right? Like, you've got lightning in a bottle there, and it's not going to stay in a bottle.
But it also they also have to have a source they can trust.
Yep.
There's got to be that. That's what I worry about. There's no information source that people really trust. It's all broken into. You got Breitbart, you got the New York Times, you got everybody.
Did you see what
own.
Julian Assange tweeted out, some stats on trust in the media over the last 40 years, and the number of people who say that they don't trust the media, like, at all has gone from, like, 5% to 30%, high 20s, something like that. Mm. Trust has broken down.
And that's the point. I think that, you know, those trust mechanisms in the 1950s rested on the fact that only a tiny number of people had a microphone. And they were allowed to say what the truth was.
And it was a very homogenous population.
That's right. And it was abused. That trust was abused. It was abused by big tobacco. It was often abused by academia. Behaviorism did a lot of damage in education. So these ideas have been abused. And now that authority, that trust is gone because everybody has a microphone. That's the reality. And so the point is, I think that, you know, what the positive culture that can emerge from this is that you have no trust in any individual human's authority. And that what happens is that the crowd is gathering and challenging all of each other's ideas, and that you essentially have mechanisms for, you know, there is an information space, and we're all constantly curating it, testing it, refining it. And that's, I think, the opportunity. I think that's where this energy has to be channeled.
I agree with that. What scares me a little bit is that there can be a purposefully provocative event by 300 people in a city like Charlottesville, 300 people that I don't agree with, which is an understatement, and they want a reaction. And the reaction to that has pretty much the most powerful people in the world, with the exception of Donald Trump, like, universally condemning it, changing rules on free speech, like changing views on whether like political violence is justified. And I'm sitting back here and I'm like, these were 300 LARPers
exactly.
in a fucking
exactly.
field. And we're going to rewrite our social contract
exactly.
because of these like dudes with tiki torches,
it's mob mentality.
And polo shirts and like painted wooden shields.
Yeah.
Like,
it's mob mentality.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but the most powerful people in the world all were willing to rewrite the social contract based on that one moment.
What do you mean?
I mean, free speech is about, and freedom to assemble is about a basic of a right as
yeah.
there is in
yeah.
America. And if,
yeah.
and if
it doesn't
you think
exist anymore, certainly not in the workplace. But, yeah.
It's see, that's the thing. That's also
you get
what
fired.
Concerns
you get fired
me.
For making for writing a reasonable memo.
Yeah, and people
and by
say,
the way, a memo meant to help. A memo meant to say, if you guys want to close, if you guys want to close the gender gap, let's look at some biology here. And you fired him.
Yeah.
Shame on you.
Yeah.
It really makes it very difficult for me to have respect for that side of the argument. It really does. I don't respect that, and
no.
I think it's tyrannical.
It's absolutely tyrannical. And shit.
You were saying
what was it?
You were saying these LARPers and
changing the social contract.
How powerful people.
Well, okay. So freedom of speech, and people will say, well, freedom of speech doesn't mean that there aren't consequences to what you say. Like if you say something awful, your employer can fire you, and that is true. But there is also a dynamic of a chilling effect on freedom of speech, where if there are enough institutions that where basically the enforcement mechanism. Like freedom of speech, there needs to be a buffer zone where people have the ability to be wrong or stupid without them ending up in jail or like effectively.
Or
like
fired.
Excommunicated
or fired
or stuff like that.
Having their careers that they've worked their whole life on like destroyed.
Right. I mean
that's a form of murder, man. I don't care what anybody says.
Yeah.
You know, we all work really hard to get where we're at. And if a 50-year-old man or, you know, and you take away his means to earn a living, that's violent to me.
Yeah.
That's a form of violence.
Yeah.
And if you don't know that, then you've never worked for a living.
I mean, I know multiple people who have been fired for tweets that they've made. And, you know, in one circumstance have seen somebody, like, no longer be able to get a mainstream job. And, like, when that happens to someone, they don't moderate in their views. They radicalize in their views.
Well, but also you're now saying that is a form of violence, right? So you're now talking about, you know, how does that fit with your view of safe spaces, right? You're saying real danger is you're in a coal mine and you're dying, but now you're saying that, you know, losing your job is a form of violence.
Well, yeah, because I think sometimes it can when you spend your whole life trying to get somewhere and your reputation is destroyed and everything you've worked for is just taken away from you because of mob. It's a mob mentality. And by the way, because the one side of the ideology has won the day, one side of the ideology has gained some power and pressure and forced reasonable people to take cowardly acts and fire somebody because, well, I guess that's going to make the world better. You're not making the world better. You're punishing somebody. Punishment doesn't change behavior. It just pushes it under the rug, and it probably festers there.
And it seemed like we used to have more domains in civic life that were apolitical, almost explicitly apolitical. And it seems like more and more institutions, companies are being forced or want to take political stands, and that if you're trying to, you know, have freedom of speech, like with a buffer zone around it, where you can have freedom to make a mistake or say something wrong or say something right that a lot of people don't believe, you know, we don't.
Well, the one thing that I will say, just because obviously there's such a bromance between you two, and there's just like so much idea sex happening back and forth. And so I just want to try and, you know, sort of represent what I think the other side might say. And in the same way that, you know, you work really, really hard and you want an opportunity and then it's taken away from you, I think that's, you know, a lot of the articles that came out written by women in tech is that, you know, they've worked very hard, they've been just as good as the job, and then they are constantly dismissed and discounted. And I think the problem is that you know, for me, this whole James DeMaury thing reminded me a lot of, you know, the resurgence of Charles Murray, where absolutely, you know, there are people who sort of have these beliefs and they're not as thoughtful as you guys, right? And what ends up happening is they latch onto it and they're like, see, there's a scientist that says black people are dumb.
Yeah, but guess what? You don't fire the person for doing that. You don't shoot the messenger. It's the way you have a debate, and he has a right to express a point of view because he's trying to solve a problem, by the way, and he's pointing to agreed upon biology research, and actually, I'm not a sexist and trying to make a difference. I read the women, a lot of the women programmers, one who teaches at I think it was Princeton or whatever, but I read their rebuttals to this. I read their uncharitable criticism of this. They have a right to be that way. They have a right to feel that way. I have no problem with them voicing their contempt, and I sympathize with the fact that it's a very hard place for a woman to make her bones when you got 15 dudes in a room and you're the only female programmer. C'est la fucking vie. And I'm dead serious because we'll try to fix that. But I don't think you fire somebody who's trying to fix it by using biological examples of how maybe we should focus our eye over here a little bit because it might solve the problem. Firing him to me was outrageous. Look, you want to talk about the forefront of feminism? You want to talk about people who really make a difference? MMA, mixed martial arts. The UFC, the most male-dominated part of the world. Those women are fascinating. Joanna Jędrzejczyk, and sorry, Joanna, your name, I can't pronounce it, but she is as exciting a fighter. Amanda Nunes, Chris Cyborg, you're talking about some of the baddest females on the planet. Their skill level is so high. Their jiu-jitsu, their wrestling, and their striking, their kicking. Nobody opened any doors for those women. Dana White said women will never fight in the UFC, and now they draw. They draw guys like me. I don't watch female basketball. I don't watch women's softball. I don't watch women's golf. I watch women's tennis. I watch women's gymnastics. Women can be just as exciting in fighting. I never would have believed you. I never would have believed you. I watched them with the same fervor and interest, and they earned it. They earned it on their own, and they literally punched and kicked and submitted their way to the top. And that's how you do it. That's how you do it. Sometimes it doesn't mean the government doesn't have a role to play. It doesn't mean the government doesn't come in and say that's anti-discriminatory. They did a great job in some instances. If black people are just not allowed to work somewhere, yeah, I'm all for some legislation for anti-discrimination legislation. But please keep in mind that I would suggest that what did a lot to repair race relations or change white hearts and minds in this country was the character and the grit and the skill and the intelligence that black athletes displayed on the sports field, on the court. Arthur Ashe and Pele and Muhammad Ali and Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson, and the list goes on and on, and Serena Williams and Venus Williams. When you see those people exhibit that kind of character, that kind of skill, that kind of grit, that kind of intelligence, that's, and was the playing field equal? Look, man, sports are beautiful because you can't fake them. You either win or you lose. And nobody was in there to make it easier for anybody. To me, that's where real progress is made. I mean, Ronda Rousey, I'm proud to have known her. I didn't like the way she handled some things, but I knew Ronda. Ronda never limited herself to anything. Ronda never even listened to that shit. Ronda was like, my body's not made to fuck millionaires. My body's made to kick ass and solve fights. My body's made for accomplishment. I never forgot her the way she said that. I that's how I'll raise my daughter. She changed my mind. She changed my chauvinistic mind. And nobody did that in the Yale, you know, women's study fucking field. I didn't read any of those books. You know, it's very, I'm tactile, and I think that's how you do it. And so we have to keep those examples in mind. We really do. Because nobody in the MMA field, none of those women were whining. I watch all of them, and I watch those fights very carefully. And that's a huge, huge, who would have ever thought that the UFC, that MMA gyms, I know these guys, that they would have been in an indirect way or whatever you want to call it, the catalysts to some of the biggest advancement in female sports, period. That's incredible to me. And they didn't, you know, those guys are, they didn't make it easy on women. They're not sexist. They were just like, man, the bitch can hit and if the bitch can kick and punch, right. Fucking welcome. I'll spar with her. I've seen it. I was at Hensel Gracie's Jiu-Jitsu Academy. I rolled with women, some really good ones, you know? And so what? How surprising, how egalitarian. The patriarchy actually seemed to be not so oppressive in that instance. Because those women were like, fuck off, I'm showing up. And some of them were hot, and some of them are hot. Some of them wear makeup and have incredible bodies and pose in a bikini. And they'll punch you in the face and knock you the fuck out. And that we don't talk about that enough.
No. And you know, they earned the respect of men. And that
they
feeling.
They earned it.
They earned it.
On an even playing field.
Yep.
And it's condescending.
And they wanted to earn it.
And it's
on
condescending
an even
to think that people can't do that in other fields.
Right.
And there
are fields where there are many more women than men. And we don't, you know, we don't talk about those. Or there are fields, you know, Wall Street used to be, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, much more of a focus of, you know, women, female executives. Wall Street has fallen out of favor. It's no longer a trendy industry, and so now it's shifted to the tech world. And so I think there's a, you know, you look at, you actually, when you look at studies of the most egalitarian societies, like Sweden and parts of Scandinavia, they have the most differences between like male and female job preferences. They get more exaggerated the more egalitarian because people apparently have different, men and women have different interests in general, on average, and they gravitate towards things that they like and that they're good at, some combination of that. There's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that.
But I think Brian, often you talk about the sort of exceptionalism of sports and comedy because they are so obviously egalitarian, right? Like, you know, if you're funny, people laugh. If you're good at fighting, you win. And the point is that the reason why those are potentially exceptional is because that's where there is the clearest set of criteria, right? And maybe in other areas, it's, you know, if you've got a bunch of job applicants that are coming in with resumes, right, maybe there is unconscious bias that goes into determining how people are selected. Now, I don't think that James DeMora should have been fired, right? He wanted to open a conversation, and I think anytime anybody wants to open a conversation, that's great. Let's have that conversation out and work through all the science, and I mean all the science, right, from everybody's sides and sort through that and actually start to resolve what does all the evidence say.
The challenge is when one side wants to moralize an issue, and some issues should be moralized, like full stop, but when one side wants to moralize the issue, they say, this is the type of thing we are not going to debate, period. And so, like, when somebody does that, all you have left are power politics, like pure power plays.
Yeah, and that's what has to be fought because
right.
It doesn't help change anything.
But the question is, how do you fight it? I mean, I think part of what's interesting about living in the age of the internet is that we get to create our own forum, and we get to have spaces like this where we can model reasonable conversation, where we don't necessarily agree on everything. We have different areas of expertise and different areas of knowledge, and then we can pool that all in the middle, sort through it, and see what are the most reasonable conclusions based on the currently available evidence. And I think that's, you know, there's a guy in the Mixed Mental Arts Facebook group who said something that I really like, Matt Russell. And he said, the place that we've reached now with politics is blood versus Crips. You know, it doesn't really matter whether you choose Team Blue or Team Red. Either way, you're just fueling the conflict, and you lose.
I mean, we're not just Team Blue versus Team Red. Right now, we've got the brown shirts and the red shirts.
Yeah.
I mean, I decided to watch a documentary last night.
That's my dog, everybody. I will be putting him down for that.
A History Channel documentary on, like, Nazi stuff. And they had, like, brown shirts and red shirts, like paramilitary organizations in the streets fighting each
sure.
other.
Yeah.
And both sides initially benefited from that.
Yeah. This is what you have to worry about. Are you optimistic or pessimistic? I guess it depends, right?
I am short medium-term pessimistic. I think it's going to get more polarized, and I think it's going to get more violent, unfortunately. I hope I'm wrong. I'm still optimistic long-term.
Do you think Trump will last, or will he resign?
I don't think he's going to resign.
Is he the problem or just a symptom?
Both. I mean, he wouldn't have been... he wouldn't have been elected if he didn't touch on real issues and discontents that large numbers of people had.
There was a quote I read that is by Brett, I can't remember his name, and he wrote a biography of Steve Bannon, and I think he starts it with Trump. Trump presented his or paraded his hey, Trump paraded his shamelessness as fearlessness. And his charlatanism as charisma, and people believed. Do you believe that? You think he's a charlatan? And
he's a good salesman. He's always been a good salesman. And anytime someone's a good salesman, you can walk the line between legitimate sales and BS. On the other hand, like he is a billionaire. He does have, most people would say, a good family. Say what you want about his infidelities and whatever, his ex-wives seem to be on good terms with him, which is more than, like, a lot of people can say.
Complicated guy. Yeah. Not all bad. What a surprise. Not all bad.
Not all bad. And he some people say shameless. In many ways, he has never quite fit in to elite Manhattan culture. And he's always been more like new money or sort of gauche.
Yeah.
And was never sort of part of the club. You know, he opened another club in Palm Beach that allowed blacks and Jews and whatever else. And he got a lot of credit because it wasn't like the typical like WASPy Palm Beach thing because he was excluded from that society. So, you know, I think he is, I do think he's more complicated, but he is willing to fight fire with fire. That's how he views it, and he won't back down. And he makes his opponents make mistakes because they get so worked up and they get so frenzied that they overplay their hand. I mean, there are all sorts of pictures going around social media right now. Whatever you want to say about the bad people on both sides or good people on both sides comments, there are now pictures all over social media of all the violence that Antifa has been perpetuating over the last couple of years. And a Mitt Romney would not have done that. So a lot of people on the right are like, well, he could be doing better. He's made some verbal slip-ups. He should have had probably a better statement on Charlottesville. On the other hand, he fights in a way that our leaders never have before. And he makes the right people angry. That's what I think continues to be underestimated, is there's a non-trivial proportion of people on Trump's side that even if he's not achieving something that they want him to achieve, he's pissing off a lot of the right people.
Hmm. John Durant, you're always fun to talk to, man. You really are. You always have a really fresh perspective.
It's great.
I look forward to stealing a lot of what you have to say.
And monetizing it.
Oh, yeah, and making myself look great. Because that's what these podcasts are about.
Hey, look, if you want to take my ideas and get fired, that's your prerogative.
That's what I'm going to do. Yeah. And by the way, we're going to be releasing one a week because we have a studio now and we're taking Mixed Mental Arts to another level. Thank you. Thanks to Hunter Motz, who's kept this whole thing going. So it's always a privilege to talk to you guys because you guys are smart and fair-minded and you think differently. And, you know, that's really the motto of this podcast, think different. I just came up with that. I'm a thief. Hunter wants to say something probably really nice about me.
That's correct, Brian. Do you know what Einstein said about creativity?
I do.
But remind us.
Creativity consists in hiding your sources. So the point is you shouldn't feel bad about the stealing, Brian, because you're just doing what Einstein would have done.
Yeah, cultural appropriation.
I hear that all the time. I'm like, you're the muscular Einstein. That's so weird. Did I tell you I'm fast twitch muscle? I did my genome. That's why I got some explosion. Don't try to sprint with me, and certainly don't put on some boxing gloves because I get the jump on you. I don't need the kind of technique a lot of guys need good fundamentals, not the kid.
I've got him in a headlock right now. You can't see that.
That's why I'm making these weird noises. Ladies and gentlemen, once again, thank you for tuning in to Mixed Mental Arts. We'll be back soon. I love these conversations. Peace.